The Guardian.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace. From the unusual to the extraordinary, your website stands out when you build it with Squarespace. Start your free trial today at squarespace.com/guardian.
Hello, I'm Ollie Mann, and that was an advert. And this is an advert, sort of, for what's coming up on Tech Weekly. Advertising. It pays for most of the free content that we enjoy watching and reading and listening to online. We all understand that, and we certainly wouldn't want to block out ads and deprive businesses of making money, would we? Would we? Well, last month, the world's most valuable business, Apple, rolled out an iOS update that included content blocking extensions for Safari. So you can now browse the web ad-free on your iPhone. Great for the consumer, potentially devastating for publishers who rely on ads to generate revenues. So what happens next? Joining me to discuss will be Dean Murphy, CEO of Crystal, one of the most successful of the new Apple ad blocking apps, and Ilico Elia from ad agency Digitas LBI. And as ever, I'll be joined by the finest brains from The Guardian, or the ones who are available anyway. This week, assistant media editor Jasper Jackson, group product manager Pat Sterling, and our intrepid tech explorer, Alex Hearn. Right, that's the ad over for now. Concentrate, there's content coming. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. Now, you don't like ads. I don't like ads. Let's face it, no one likes ads. They're annoying and distracting, and it's no surprise that web-savvy millennials are choosing more and more to turn them off. But I don't know about you, I've always recognised there's no such thing as a free lunch, so I've never even investigated downloading ad-blocking software. I'd rather grit my teeth and lend my eyeballs out for a few seconds than lose my favourite publishers to bankruptcy. Alex Hearn, do you take a similarly noble position?
I do, but I have come to agree with a lot of people who block ads because of the justification that web ads are terrible. Pop-over video ads that you can't click away and that force you to watch it to watch a video halfway through a text article are hateful. Adverts which dispose malware on your computer, which are increasingly common as the big ad networks get less and less easy to control for publishers, they are also hateful. And so I've taken to being a bit of a hardball when it comes to what publishers I actually deal with. There's some who I don't block their ads, I just block their sites. I use a different content blocker, not an ad blocker, to just make it so that if I click on a link to that site, it comes up with a little thing, you know, written by me for me saying, nah, mate, it's not worth it. This article will not be worth the hassle it'll take to read it. And it's a bit sad.
Do you wish now we know that people have made loads of money out of selling ad blocking software that you'd released your Name app?
I think the thing is most people aren't likely to take that sort of hard ass approach. It's only really a mixture of the fact that I make a living working for ad supported media and I have enough of the knowledge behind how it all works to carefully pick and choose which sites I personally think have adverts which are egregious enough that I'm willing to go, no, it's not worth it.
Okay, so you're an ad-blocking sympathiser, if not an ad-blocking user.
Exactly.
But ad-blocking's been around for ages, hundreds of millions of downloads on desktop. What's changed now? What happened when iOS 9 came out?
So iOS 9 was the first time that you could block adverts on Apple's mobile browser. Safari is the only fully featured browser available for iPhones. And before this latest version of the operating system, if you wanted to use Safari, you had to view the web as the publishers delivered it to you. There was no way of blocking adverts in it. The fact that you now can, in its own way, means that just ad blocking's spread to another platform. But it also is the first time it's really properly easy. Installing an extension on Chrome, even, which is a web browser that makes it easy to do that sort of thing, is still seen as something that's a bit of a techie thing to do. Most people don't do that. Most people use their browsers as they come out of the box and don't really dig around in the settings. Installing apps on an iPhone is different. Everyone does it. If you have a smartphone, you will have installed an app. And so it's made it something that is for the first time normal people might do.
And those normal people perhaps aren't thinking about the fact that they're playing into a giant war here between Apple and Google and Facebook. This isn't just about their convenience, is it? Apple doesn't have skin in the game, as they say, with ad blocking.
Right. Well, I mean, in its own way, Apple does have skin in the game. It's just got skin on the exact opposite side of Google and Facebook. Apple doesn't really make money from adverts. It has an advert platform called iAds, which makes a minuscule amount of its revenue. Google is an advertising company with a profitable web business on the side. Something like 67% of all of its revenue comes from web ads. So for Apple, there's kind of all upside if adverts disappear from the web. It still makes money selling expensive hardware to customers, while its single biggest competitor loses two-thirds of its revenue. Brilliant.
And has it been brilliant so far from their point of view? How's it been going? How many people have downloaded this
from stuff? Apple's point of view, well, it's the apps, the ad blocking apps have been hugely popular. They shot to the top of the download charts on the first day they were available. There's been a bit of teething problems for Apple themselves. They had a big cull of apps which block ads in the wrong way. Some ad blocking apps decided that they would push a bit further and block adverts inside other apps as well. That apparently for Apple was too far. But I think given the coverage they've got and given how undeniably popular these features have been, they've got to be looking back and going, yeah, that was a good choice.
Okay. Undeniably popular, Alex says, with customers. Jasper, you've been following this from our media desk. I think it's safe to say probably not undeniably popular with the world's largest publishers, this move.
It's not popular with any publishers. The vast majority of them are still hoping that digital ads will somehow replace all the money they're losing from print advertising and sales. This is basically an existential threat to the future of the publishing industry, anyone who hopes they can actually make money online.
Unless, of course, they've followed the model that some of the publishers do of having a paywall. This only affects, really, the publishers who have put all of their potential earnings into advertising display.
There are very few publishers out there who are making a lot of money or enough money just from paid content to actually kind of completely make up for the advertising revenue they are losing in print and the advertising that they could lose from ad blockers.
And of course, I mean, we're talking about publishers inevitably at The Guardian. We're going to think about, you know, The Guardian as a newspaper branching out online, and we'll be talking a bit about that in just a moment. But of course, publishers in this setting means anyone with a website. This could be a website selling stuff as well. It doesn't have to be. It could be a blog. I mean, it's anything that's on the internet is a publisher of advertising, potentially.
I mean, absolutely. I think, you know, talking to people, it seems like some of the worst hit, or the ones that this actually could kill, tend to be sort of possibly smaller publishers, but also medium-sized publishers who, you know, have a lot of staff, have, you know, overheads, offices, but don't have the kind of reserves The Guardian or even, you know, most decent-sized newspapers have to try and work out a way around the ad blocking, come up with new kinds of ads like native ads, which BuzzFeed has sort of become famous for, but everyone's trying. It's the kind of medium-sized publishers who don't have that time and don't have that cushion who could actually be killed by this in, yeah, the not-too-distant future.
And then a word that comes up when you start looking into this area is whitelisting, which is something that I hadn't encountered before. Explain to us what that is. It sounds to me quite a bit like extortion.
Yeah, I mean, it's been described as racketeering, extortion, etc. There's been legal challenges against it. What it is so the largest ad-blocking software, the most popular, is called Adblock Plus, and that's made by a company from Germany called AO. And they operate a whitelisting system, which basically offers... allows some publishers' ads, it's roughly about 300 publishers now, to go through as long as they meet certain criteria. So they're not meant to be annoying, they're meant to be clearly marked, they're not meant to be interruptive of the experience of actually reading something. Most of those publishers aren't actually paying to be on this whitelist, but the bigger ones are being asked by this company to actually cough up no one actually knows how much money they're asking for. All the deals are kept private. No one's sort of admitting to it publicly. We know Google are paying for it. We know some of the other big web companies are paying for it. It's arguably definitely extortion, because they're basically saying, we'll take away your main revenue model if you don't give us some money.
Well, Pat Sterling, you are the group product manager here at The Guardian. So let's talk about the position of this particular institution, one of the biggest online publishers in the world, but it runs at a loss. Will losing mobile advertising eyeballs make that much difference, actually, to the bottom line here, even though it's a website that is very much depending on advertising? It's one that isn't making money anyway.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, the points that have been raised so far are really good ones around the size of publishers. So you do have these kind of players who can appeal to the ethics, or, you know, in the direct relationship that readers have with them, and then you have these very large players who probably can't. It's not genuine to sort of do so. The Guardian I think fits a rather interesting halfway house there. We're not the hugest. We certainly have a big audience, but we also have an audience who are quite sort of engaged and you could argue quite aligned with the values of that organization. So the way that we are looking at this is that ultimately it's the readers that are going to sort of dictate what happens here. They're finally, after many years, now got a way to vote with their feet, if you like, or vote with their browser extensions, and they're doing so. So we've seen a rather high uptake on desktop. With mobile, it's really not very large at all. We haven't seen a huge uptake in this, but there's nothing necessary now stopping that. Now, we don't offer them lots of options at the moment as to other ways that they could support The Guardian, and that's definitely something which we're exploring and that we increasingly are going to do more about.
And one of the ways you're being innovative is with The Guardian's membership scheme. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that's been around for about a year now, I suppose. It's kind of a program which we've launched to allow a couple of things, I suppose. Readers to kind of actually come in and be part of some of the things that The Guardian does, have live events, etc. But increasingly also, we've found that it's a way that readers will express their support of what The Guardian's doing generally. And one of the things that we've done is deliberately, when somebody has an ad blocker switched on, talk to them about that and said, there are other ways that you can support The Guardian. We recognize that you've got an ad blocker on and that you don't really want to have ads in your experience, but just so that you can support The Guardian in other ways. And we've seen a relatively positive response to that. And we have to do a much, much better job, not just The Guardian, but I would say the publishing industry generally, at talking to the readers out there about how and why it is that we make our money. Because, not everybody understands that there is a direct relationship between the advertising that people see on the site or other models with the fact that we can keep the lights on here and continue to publish great content.
Okay, fascinating stuff. Well, we're going to return to some of those themes later in the show. First of all, though, let's talk about the sector of the industry that is actually benefiting from this revolution. It isn't bad news for everyone. Publishers are losing their ad revenues, yes, but ad-blocking app developers, they're making money. Crystal was one of the early winners in the gold rush of iOS ad-blocking apps, getting over 200,000 downloads and over $167,000 since its launch in mid-September. Dean Murphy is the developer of Crystal and joins me now. Hi there, Dean.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Hello. No, not at all. Welcome to the show. Did you realise this would be just as big an opportunity as it has proven to be?
Not at all. As someone who does this as a hobby, I never actually thought it'd shoot up to the top of the charts worldwide. It was quite surprising.
Why did you think to develop ad blocking software in the first place?
Okay, it all started a few months ago when Apple announced the content blocking extension for iOS within WWDC, their yearly developer conference. I had a little play around with it. I tried it on one of my favourite sites, and I found that the load time dropped dramatically from 11 seconds to load down to 2 seconds to load when I was just loading up their homepage. So I just developed it over a few months and tested it on a lot of other sites, and it had pretty much the same results. So it seems to just improve the performance quite a lot.
So was it really all about load times for you? It wasn't about getting rid of annoying advertising, or was it a bit of both?
Annoying advertising does play a large part in it, like the pop-up ads and the adverts that redirect you to the App Store and videos automatically load and just start playing. That was a big part of it. But I didn't realise that the side effects of removing them would also be a huge performance gain of loading up to 4 times quicker and use a lot less data.
There's a rival developer of yours who started an app called Peace, which I'm sure you're aware of. It was also topping the charts initially. Now, he came out and actually withdrew his app from the store, didn't he? And he said he had a change of heart because, in his words, it just doesn't feel good. Do you understand what he meant by that?
Yeah, definitely. I know he's under a lot of pressure. He's got a lot of friends within the publishing industry. And also, I think the product that he wanted to make is a little bit more required a lot more effort than what he wanted to put into it. He said that a more nuanced approach is required to what he can put into it or what he wants to put into it.
And what that nuance meant from his point of view was, basically, we don't deprive the good guys of their revenue stream, but I don't mind taking it off Murdoch. I mean, that's basically what he meant, isn't it? Now, are you doing any nuance in your approach or not?
On my approach, I'm currently working on adding a whitelist feature so people can choose to support the websites that they want. And I'm also implementing the acceptable ads feature where there's an option in the app to show ads by more ethical advertisers who show very lightweight advertising.
Alex?
That acceptable ads feature, that's drawn from AO, isn't it? The makers of AdBlock Plus.
IO, yeah.
IO. You took IO's list of sites which are acceptable to block and which the company felt should be whitelisted, and you incorporated it in your own ad blocking software. Do you think that approach is going to spread? Are we going to end up in a situation where there's just one shared block list for everyone?
Quite possibly. I mean, IO have released a good criteria of basically what deems adverts acceptable or not. It's not actually implemented in Crystal at the moment. I just want to clarify that. It's going to be implemented within the next month or so. In regards to fragmentation, I believe they kind of open source their information. So, I mean, the list is completely free to see. And also it's going to be managed by an independent body early next year. At the moment, it's managed by IO and all done within an open forum as well.
That list has been rather controversial. I mean, IO themselves have been accused of extortion for running it. Are you're okay with the way it's run? Are you okay with the fact that IO demands payment from bigger publishers who are on it?
Well, there's always going to be an administration fee attached to it because it is a lot of work to manage, I'd imagine. It's something that I couldn't do on my own, for example, which is one of the options I explored.
Well, you say you can do it on your own, Dean. I mean, we've got Pat Sterling here who works in content for The Guardian. You can do live negotiation on the podcast if you want. How much money do you want from The Guardian so that you don't block our ads?
I couldn't put a price on that, I'm afraid.
It's certainly valuable. Yeah. Pat, would you be prepared to pay Dean so that people could see our adverts on the Guardian website?
Well, I think people are already paying Dean, which is good. In terms of negotiating around these things, the Guardian's, I don't think, in a position to really be able to do that. We've got enough trouble as it is kind of keeping the lights on. I think there's a couple of things here, right? You've got a program which has been launched by someone which potentially you have to pay a given ad blocker for to get your ads through a whitelist. Then what happens, my next question would be, what happens if that user has two or three different ad blockers and for each one, in theory, you have to pay to get through? It sort of quickly becomes unsustainable very, very quickly.
Yeah, Dean, could you imagine a situation where all the ad blocking apps get together and form a sort of ad blocking union?
On my point of view, this is exactly why I'm just not interested in the negotiation side or to contact publishers. And to be honest, Crystal has a very, in terms of like the whole market, Crystal has a very small market share in terms of like the whole ad blocking market.
I think people hearing your accent will be pleased that at least you're doing it for Britain, Dean.
yes, I'm in the UK.
I was surprised. Most of your rivals are US based, I presume.
Yeah, a lot of them are in America. I'm not sure of anyone else in the UK doing this, so I think I'm the only one, I believe.
Well, look, I mean, as Pat was saying, you know, not everyone around this table agrees with the opportunity you've taken, but well done for finding the opportunity. Are you going to be able to earn enough this year off Crystal for that to be your job?
Yes, hopefully I will. That is the plan, to work on Crystal full-time, be able to develop it into a better product, a more nuanced product that's a lot more fair with publishers.
Well, coming up, I'll be speaking to one of the men looking to eliminate annoying ads from advertising. But he does work in advertising. And we'll discuss how The Guardian plans to deal with dwindling returns in what was already a tough landscape for publishers. That's after this.
If you're a developer working on a mobile app or website and you're searching for a simple payment solution, look no further than Braintree V.0. This snippet of code allows you to accept PayPal, Apple Pay, credit and debit cards and more from customers around the world, all with a single integration. For more information and to try out the sandbox, go to braintreepayments.com/techweekly now.
Believe it or not, advertisers don't actually try to make annoying adverts. Yet, as we've seen, much of the content is so irritating people will pay to avoid it. One digital agency say they're trying to do things differently.
To launch Taco Bell's new mobile ordering app, we had to be louder and more disruptive than anyone else. With 1.6 million apps already in the App Store, we knew we had to go uber big on all Taco Bell's social channels.
Or we could shut them all down. And launch their new app by making it the only place fans could engage with Taco Bell. A full-scale blackout across every social channel, making the message clear. The new way to Taco Bell was only in the app.
An ad there from the digital agency Digitas LBI. Their head of mobile is here with me now, Ilikó Ilie. Ilikó, explain a little bit what we were just listening to. So that was the Taco Bell blackout.
Yeah, so the whole point of the new application was that you could order Taco Bell products. And so the only way we enable people to order those products is through the application itself. So there's no Twitter, no Facebook, no TV, no any other advertising medium at all, just the application, which is basically advertising in reverse and therefore caused a splash and therefore made it advertising.
Yeah, so it's a press stunt that obviously is difficult to repeat, but yes. It was making the point that actually people are saturated by ads for fast food companies in the US where this campaign happened, and actually you can make just as much of a splash by doing something clever as you can by just filling every possible box.
And I think the word clever is the exact word to use there, because you have to do something clever now. And I think that's what the ad blockers are sort of forcing publishers and advertisers and agencies and the whole advertising industry to do, is find clever ways to get people to look at your product. Where I'm actually worried is if it simply makes publishers, for example, innovate in the tech stack only and try and innovate their way around the problem, as opposed to innovation in making advertising better.
Ilie, you worked as the head of mobile for Reuters before this current job, so you've seen things from the side of publisher and client. Do the two sides agree? I mean, because, you know, as an agency, you can say, oh, we've had this really clever, fun, smart idea, but if you're the person who's either putting the money into it or relying on the revenue from it, it's a bit harder perhaps to subscribe to.
Yeah, but I think everyone absolutely agrees that advertising needs to be better. The problem we've got is that it's so simple to make a bad ad that it's sort of sometimes almost not worth making a really good one because it costs so much more to do. Where you need to work out what the difference is you need to work out that the better advertising are exponentially better than bad advertising. People don't not like advertising, they don't like bad advertising.
Okay, I don't like advertising. I mean, when I'm watching a video on YouTube, for example, I admire the way that now you've got 5 seconds or 7 seconds or whatever it is, the advertising industry has evolved to create ads that will hit me in the 5 seconds before I press skip ad. But I can't imagine a universe, unless I've lost control of my hands, where I'm going to sit and watch all 30 seconds.
So it depends.
Aren't most people like me?
Yeah, most people, virtually all people like you, absolutely. That therefore means that it's a bad ad, or a bad ad placement, or a bad ad format. So we are still at the very nascent stage of advertising, especially on mobile, and we are still learning about how good advertising is
Sometimes a great ad. I'll watch it and I think, well, that's a beautiful image of a cat in slow motion, but I want to see a clip from this morning. How can you tally those two things up? It's not what I've asked for.
So in the same way on TV, the first TV advertising campaigns was a radio presenter reading out a radio ad on TV. We now know that's not the right way to do a TV ad.
Yeah, so okay, so we're at the very, very nascent stages of what's going to be a much more nuanced, to use Dean's word, much more nuanced approach to advertising.
Not to advertising, to making money for all the different parties. That's the issue.
And that's the crucial thing, isn't it? We were talking a bit about native advertising earlier, Pat. I mean, what's The Guardian doing to sort of deal with this and the different ways that you can try and make money without annoying the audience?
Yeah, so we've got... We've obviously got a native advertising product, if you'd like to call it. There's many definitions of native advertising, and they run the gamut from something that looks much like a display ad but kind of feels like it belongs more, all the way through to sort of outlinks and things like that, which just look very much like the content that's on the page, but actually pushes you off to some entire third party and all the sort of things in between. Now, The Guardian's kind of got some of those things already, some of which gets blocked by ad blockers and some of which doesn't. And so you could obviously see, perhaps we'd start to think more about how we innovate towards the things that don't get blocked by ad blockers, but continues to satisfy the needs of both our advertisers and not kind of annoy our readers to the point where they're going to do something else to try to stop that happening. And I think that we've had ad blocking is really a very, very firm shot across the bow of the internet's business model. You know, back in the early days of the internet, and that's only kind of 10 to 15 years ago, really, adverts really weren't considered so much of a problem. People's attitudes toward adverts online were fairly, you know, they weren't necessarily positive, but they certainly weren't anywhere near as negative as they are now. I think the point earlier was the right one. We haven't necessarily got to the point where we've got all the right things.
But is it true of millennials, for example, that they are negative about advertising? Because it seems to me, you're right, they might not like the old-fashioned banner ad, but they're actually quite at home with the idea of their favourite YouTuber being sponsored by the trainers that they're wearing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's a really interesting way of pushing advertising to make it much more useful. So as soon as advertiser becomes useful, it becomes content. And then as an advertiser or a sponsor of that content, you sort of want to work out how do you increase the respect you're given for enabling good content rather than paying to put your brand in front of a consumer. And that's, I think, where advertisers sort of want to start going. They want to start getting respect for enabling good content.
Do you think, Jasper, that the temptation in the media industry is just to go where the money is as much as possible? You're not really going to have a conversation inside your building that makes your TV channel or your newspaper and think, well, this isn't quite the right fit for us if there's loads of money on the table. But essentially, it seems what Illy's saying to me is, you know, that the publisher should be saying just as much as the brand, are we a good fit for each other so we don't annoy people?
I mean, short-term thinking is what's sort of got most of the publishing industry into the trouble it's in now. And it's, you know, all these annoying ads are happening because someone in a meeting has been told, it's not having enough impact. Why don't we make it fill the whole page, or we need them to watch a video? And people have just gone, okay, it's probably going to piss people off, but they've got no choice. And that's what's led us to this point. But I think for a lot of publishers, there's a sort of more, a bigger problem with what Illico is saying is that, you know, you're talking about YouTubers, you're talking about an app. None of this really needs a newspaper or a magazine or, you know, even any kind of professional content maker. You just need the advertiser and whoever they're paying directly. You don't necessarily need The Guardian to get your ads across.
And Jasper, is there a sort of big solution for this being organised by the big companies that have their toes in the water?
Well, I mean, Google has very recently come up with kind of its own fight back aimed both at the ad blockers and sort of Apple in general, which is Google AMP. And the idea behind this is to tackle that page loading issue to make pages load much, much faster. I mean, they're aiming for instantaneous. What this does, it's a cut down version of web pages, Guardian pages, New York Times pages, with simpler code, similar kind of rules about what kind of ads you're allowed to use, in the early stages, rules about what additional features you're allowed to use. It's good for publishers because Google is saying, we will still let you serve ads, we will still let you sell ads, as long as you're a bit more careful about how you do it. Publishers, in theory, have a lot more control. The only problem is that they're giving Google lots of power. And as the Apple ad blocking shows, having one person with that much control over your readers and how they experience your content is risky.
And that's kind of the option that's being put forward by Facebook, isn't it, Alex? You've got instant articles, which, Pat, I know is something that The Guardian have teamed up with Facebook to do. You spend more time within Facebook reading something off another website, but it's monetized by Facebook. Is that the other option?
Well, I mean, yeah. Ultimately, the option all of these platform holders want is to pull publishers off the open web onto their own platform. Facebook doesn't want you to have to leave Facebook to do anything. And it's working. You know, in the West, the open web is still quite a big thing. In the developing world, there are people who It's not that they think Facebook is the internet. They think they don't have the internet, but they do have Facebook. Ultimately, for Facebook, that's brilliant. And in its dream world, that would creep up market, and it would become the way the majority of people in the developed world would access the net. For publishers, that wouldn't be great. But at the same time, the deal Facebook is making right now is, well, look, at least if people access your content through our app, they can't block the ads on it.
Yeah, Spotify model, basically. Better the devil you know. Exactly. I mean, Pat, do you think there'll be a winner in this race, Google, Facebook, Apple? Or it seems to me those three companies are all so massive, they're not going anywhere. You've got to work with everybody.
Yeah, we do. And I think that's, I mean, definitely The Guardian's got a kind of a track record of wanting to be involved no matter what. Sometimes you'd argue we kind of rush in, but ultimately, you know, being part of these things, it means that you can kind of influence them. The stated aims of all those programs, or at least Facebook and Google's, is to say the internet's broken, particularly on mobile, and we think we're better at fixing it than anyone else. Now, Facebook's approach to this is we're better at fixing this than anyone else, and we're going to own the whole thing. Google's way is not that far off, but has a key difference, which is they're saying, look, we'll give a standard that anybody can use, and we're going to hold the keys initially and make sure that it all goes really, really fast and does what we want it to do. And then we'll see. Google's approach is, at this point, the one which points towards a more open web that works for everybody. It is a once in a decade, I would suggest, opportunity to try to change the direction of things like a not very good advertising industry. We should all kind of be looking at that, hopefully, as a chance to make the whole thing work a bit better.
Okay, well, if you've been listening to that and you are just a normal person, as Alex suggested earlier, perhaps you will now delete your ad blocking download that you've bought. Or perhaps if you work in advertising and you were inspired by what Illy says, you'll make some ads that aren't irritating. Thank you to all of you for joining me this week. That's almost all we have time for. But before we go, oh, what's this? Special surprise. I have one final guest here in the studio. It's Natalie Nahai. Hello.
Hello, how are you doing, Ollie?
I'm very well, thank you. Now, it's very important that listeners get to know you, so pay attention because you'll get to hear a lot more of Natalie over the next few weeks. Natalie, you're a best-selling author and a broadcaster. You're also a web psychologist. I'm going to ask you about that in just a second. But the reason it's important that people get to know you is as of, you're joining our podcast team as a presenter of this show.
I am. It's very exciting.
It is. You're going to be the Miranda Sawyer to my Andrew Graham Dixon. Basically, downloaders aren't going to know whether they're going to be listening to me or Natalie hosting the show, but it will be equally excellent, yeah, in different ways. So tell us, what are your interests, Natalie? What do we expect to hear from you on the show?
So as a web psychologist, I'm interested in how our online environments influence our behaviours. So how do we get persuaded to take certain actions online? How does the internet and incumbent technologies influence our behaviours and our relationships and our identity and the way in which we interact with each other in the world? So really, it's quite a broad brush, but it's looking at the hard questions as to what makes us human and then how technology influences the course of how we adapt and evolve.
Web psychologist, though, is that a term that you coined? Because what you said sounded really interesting, but not a niche that's necessarily filled with many others.
Yeah, I mean, I think I like the idea of web psychology as a term, mostly because it combines two fairly familiar things in a way that's not been combined before. So the idea of figuring out human behavior in relationship to specifically design on the web. And the reason that I thought a new term was merited was because there's all this fantastic research being done across the world, all across these different disciplines. So from things such as human-computer interaction to cross-cultural psychology, you've got kind of the persuasive tech being done in MIT by BJ Fogg and behavioral economics. And it's just so many different disciplines, each of which can give us very specific insights as to how and why we behave online the way that we do. But no one was bringing together these different disciplines and joining the dots and going, okay, well, what happens if we zoom out and look at the different ways in which these things interact and the kind of bigger picture, the bigger story that they can tell?
And we're going together to Dublin. Seems strange, I've only just met you, in a couple of weeks for the Web Summit, which is huge event. I mean, within Europe, I think it's kind of the biggest event for all the kind of big cheeses from all the big tech companies.
Yeah, it's massive.
Online companies going to be there. We're going to be there as well for Guardian Tech Weekly. What are you going to be doing there?
I'm going to be interloping. Well, I'm going to be helping to host one of the panels. I think we're going to be talking about virtual reality and identity. I'm going to try and shoehorn some sex tech in there because that's an area that I find particularly fascinating. And it's just probably going to be quite provocative and I'm hoping interesting. What are you going to be doing now?
I think I'm going to be approaching people randomly with my mic, stuffing it in their face and asking them something stupid. But yeah, I think in combination it will work well. So welcome to the team, Natalie.
Thanks for having me. Looking forward to seeing more of you.
Indeed. And I'm very much looking forward to hearing your first show as presenter next week. What are you going to be discussing?
So we're going to be talking about Ada Lovelace, who was the first computer programmer and a fellow Brit, which is very exciting. And we just celebrated the Ada Lovelace Day just this week. So that's what we'll be exploring next week.
Okay. I'm sure if she was still alive today, she'd be developing an app for ad blocking. That's what she'd be up to.
I reckon she would. Join the dark side.
That's what we've learned today. Well, welcome to the team.
Thank you.
I'll be back the week after that. We're going to be co-presenting. But that is it from me today. I'm Ollie Mann. Thank you to my producer, Alana Chance, and also to all my guests, Dean Murphy from Crystal, Ilico Ilias from Digitas LBI, and our Guardian panel, Alex Hearn, Jasper Jackson, and Pat Murphy. That's it for this Tech Weekly. Bye-bye.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.